Okay, this is Apologetics 2, Lecture Number 29. Apologetics 2, Lecture Number 29. What I'd like to do right now is discuss moral relativism, and we'll try to refute moral relativism. Now, a brief definition of moral relativism is it's the belief that there is no objective universal moral values. There's no moral values above all mankind, and therefore each person decides what is right for himself. And so that's what moral relativism is. Now, Friedrich Nietzsche, the German philosopher who lived from 1844 to 1900, he stated in his writings that if God is dead, then traditional values died with him. Now what he was saying was he was an atheist. He did believe that God did not exist. But what bothered him was that there were many atheists like himself. They disbelieved, they refused to believe in God's existence. At the same time, they accepted the traditional moral values found in the Bible. And so what Nietzsche said is, if God is dead, if we, you know, he believed that man had created, rather than God created man in his image, instead man by his imagination created God in his own image. And so what Nietzsche argued was, then we grew up, we became atheists, and then we killed God. Nietzsche would even say in real poetic language that you could hear the sound of the grave diggers and burying God. And so this God that man created died, and what Nietzsche is arguing, if God is dead, if religion is dead, if God does not exist, then traditional values have died with him. And so Nietzsche said, once you recognize that God does not exist, and Nietzsche believed that God did not exist, then there's no reason that why we should assume that the moral values taught in the Bible are true. Now, Nietzsche argued that what he called the soft values of Christianity, he believed that these soft values of Christianity stifle human creativity. It holds man's progress back. And so Nietzsche recommended that we create our own hard values, okay? Now, Nietzsche called for a breed of supermen to arise on the scene, and these supermen should create their own values through their will to power. Now, Adolf Hitler read the writings of Nietzsche, and many other Nazis did as well, and they tried to use his writings as the intellectual justification for their master race ideology. Nietzsche also predicted that the 20th century would be the bloodiest century in the history of mankind because it would be mankind come of age. In other words, the widespread belief in atheism would bring bloody consequences. But Nietzsche basically was arguing that without God, there are no absolute moral values. Without God, there are no absolute moral values. This is something that basically it logically follows. If there is no God above man, no absolute moral lawgiver above man, then what reason do we have to assume that there's going to be moral laws above men? Okay? And so because of this, you find an awful lot of atheists or agnostics, people who either question or deny God's existence, that try to come up with some reason why that we can have some concept of right and wrong, but ultimately, if there is no God, there are no absolute moral values. So that's Friedrich Nietzsche. Bertrand Russell is a British philosopher and mathematician. Russell, this is a quote from his edited work, an edited work on his writings entitled Why I Am Not a Christian. And it states, outside human desires, there is no moral standard. And so as far as Bertrand Russell is concerned, and he's an atheist, believes God doesn't exist, at least he used to believe God doesn't exist, he found out different by now, he died in 1970, he lived from 1872 to 1970, but it's his view that to say that if Phil Francis says that killing innocent people is wrong, Bertrand Russell will be saying, what I'm actually saying is, I desire that people not kill innocent children. Okay? So he acts as if moral values are nothing but human desires. They're synonymous. But the question comes up, well, what if a person desires to kill the innocent? You know, Bertrand Russell basically does not have the right. He can't be consistent with his worldview and call the actions of an Adolf Hitler wrong. Now, in actuality, Russell was inconsistent with his view. Remember, his view is that apart from human desires, there's no such thing as right and wrong. There are no moral values other than what we desire. And but he was inconsistent with this. He protested war. He was a big anti-war fanatic earlier in this century. He fought for homosexual rights way before it was popular. And so he was very inconsistent with his worldview. He acted as if there is such a thing as an absolute moral standard. A.J. Ayer lived from 1910 to, I believe, 1989. He died recently, and I believe it was 1989. Another British philosopher, he argued that moral commands merely express a person's subjective feelings. Okay, so to say that murder is wrong, what you're really saying is, I feel, my feelings tell me murder is wrong, and we're really not saying anything more than that. Jean-Paul Sartre, lived from 1905 to 1980, a French existentialist, he argued that there's no objective meaning to life, and man has to actualize himself by a leap of blind faith, an act of the will, commitment of the will. And so in the area of moral values, since there's no objective meaning to life, Sartre argued that man must create his own values. Okay, so he's very Kierkegaardian, like Søren Kierkegaard, the Danish philosopher with the leap of faith type thinking. Jean-Paul Sartre thought much along those lines. I'll throw out three different, there can be many different types of moral relativism, by the way, and sometimes they're harder to pin down. Sometimes the more complex they are, the harder it is to identify it as moral relativism. But eventually, if it is moral relativism, it will become more and more clear the more thorough of a job of researching the particular moral view. The more you study it, the more you'll find if it is in the moral relativistic camp. But hedonism is the idea that whatever brings pleasure is right. Whatever brings pleasure is right. If it feels good, do it. Okay, that's what hedonism is. And this goes way back in the history of Greek philosophy to hundreds of years before Christ. The 1960s appeared to be just a time of rampant hedonism among the hippie culture in America. But the question would come up, what about surgery to save a life? Surgery would not bring pleasure to a person. The surgery would be painful, but it might be necessary to save a life of a person, even if the person whose life is in jeopardy might not really, you know, experience much pain with the particular disease that's killing them. You know, they might go to the doctors because they've got a little lump and not feel any pain, and they find out that the lump is cancerous, and then surgery is needed. Well, there's not a whole lot of pleasure in the surgery, but the fact of the matter is the right thing to do in that situation would be the surgery, get rid of that cancer, save the life, but it would not feel real good at that particular time. To run into a burning building to save an orphan, a screaming orphan, that doesn't seem to bring a whole lot of pleasure. At the same time, that might be the right thing to do. The hedonistic position is the idea that whatever brings pleasure, the most pleasure, is right. If it feels good, do it. Utilitarianism is the view that the greatest good, what is good, is the greatest good for the greatest number. Okay? There's many problems with this particular view. One of them is, who decides what the greatest good is? Okay? The Nazis thought that the greatest good was to exterminate the Jews and to experiment on other peoples to figure out how, you know, how we can upgrade the genetic code of the world so that everybody could eventually share in the genetic code of the Aryan race. I wouldn't want the Nazis deciding what they thought the greatest good for the greatest number is. Now, the problem is, too, if you define... Can anybody tell me what the problem is if you define the good as the greatest good for the greatest number? There you go. There you hit the nail right on the head. John hit the nail right on the head. That's John Gardner. He's looking for work in theological research now. But you hit the nail right on the head. If I define, define the word tough as an attribute of a person who is extremely tough, I have told you absolutely nothing about the word tough. Okay? So rather than defining it, I'm just reusing it, and it's not telling you anything. It's the same thing here. When you ask a Christian, what does good mean? That's one thing. But when you ask an atheist what good means, it's a whole other thing. See, the Christian might just not understand what good means within his worldview. But there is a place for the word good in the Christian's worldview. In the atheist worldview, there really isn't a place for the word good, or at least a logical place for it to fit into the overall atheistic worldview. So they are really being, pushed into a corner to try, if they want to call your actions evil, then the atheist has to come up with, well, what is good? He's got to answer that question. So for him to just put the word good inside his definition shows that it's just an empty concept. And who decides the greatest good? Is it the Nazis who are going to decide? But the fact of the matter is, the greatest good for the greatest number, you might just think, I'm the elite genius. B.F. Skinner, by the way, took this type of ethic in his work Beyond Freedom and Dignity, where he believed that we should genetically engineer human beings and we should get beyond concepts of freedom and dignity. But he argued that we were all genetically... By the way, Francis Schaeffer, in his book Back to Freedom and Dignity, did an excellent refutation of B.F. Skinner there. But Skinner was arguing, he's a behaviorist, and he believed that man is just material. The immaterial realm does not exist. Man is not, the soul is not immaterial. And so B.F. Skinner was arguing that everything we do, we're not really free. We don't make free choices. Everything we do is predetermined by our genes, what we've inherited, and our environment. And just as Pavlov's pooch, where they got the dog to salivate every time the red light came on because he expected food to be there, he thought we could do the same thing with human beings. And we can program them to obey and that type of thing. But Skinner saw this as a way to better the world, take away people's freedom, take away people's dignity, and the intellectual elite, of whom he is one, by the way, And he signs the Secular Humanist Manifesto number 2 in 1973. But he believed that the intellectual elite, they are needed to guide us or even push us in a direction that we might not want to go because they know what's best for us. Now, the problem with that view is, as Francis Schaeffer pointed out, if we are a product of our genes, and if we are a product of our genes plus our environment, and therefore we are not free, then what makes the intellectual elite think that they know what direction to push us in? In other words, there's no such thing as good or bad, no such thing as right or wrong, and the intellectual elite is just as programmed as we are. So I might be moving in a different direction than them, but it's not my fault. I'm not free, and they don't get any credit because they're not free, and all we can say is both our ways are different. So, you know, to use good in your definition of good, if your worldview has a hard time explaining good, and then you define good by using the word good in your definition, it's still an empty concept. It's yet to be filled with any content. But utilitarianism, the major problem is who decides what the greatest good is. Then Jeff's pointing to himself there. Situation ethics by Joseph Fletcher. At times, this sounds almost biblical, but then when you really understand what's being said here, you find that it's worlds apart from the biblical view of morality. Joseph Fletcher argued that ethics are relative to the situation. He said that it's the only ethic. He said he only has one ethic, and it's love. So Fletcher would claim he's not a moral relativist. He would say there is one moral law, one absolute, and it is love. Okay? So he would say that love's decisions, though, are made situationally. They're not prescribed. In other words, a law like thou shalt not kill, that's not really a law. That might be a general rule, but there are some cases where killing is okay. So you have to look at the situation and then let love make the decision. The Christian response to this is, number one, the situation never determines what is right. The situation doesn't determine what is right. Point number two, God determines what is right. So in other words, we need to go into God's Word to see what we should do in the given situation. Not the situation determining it, it's God determines it in His Word, how we should react in that situation. Point three, still the situation often helps us determine which of God's laws should apply. And the fourth point, we're dealing with Norman Geisler's greater good ethic. When two of God's laws conflict, we must obey the greater good. In other words, the higher of the two laws. Then God gives us an exemption. We receive an exemption from the lesser good or the lower law. Absolute laws have no exception. So it's not that there's an exception, but you receive an exemption, okay? Because there's no way you can, for instance, Rahab the harlot, if she decided to submit to the governing authorities and to tell the truth, then she would have then turned over two godly Jewish spies, and they would have been put to death. So she felt it was a greater good to save innocent, godly human lives and to refuse to submit to the governing authorities and to lie to the governing authorities. That was not an exception to God's absolute moral law. Thou shalt not bear false witness still stands. Submit to the governing authorities still stands. The moral law remains absolute, but she got an exemption in that particular case because she had to obey a greater good, a greater law. So basically, and this is all Geisler and Feinberg in Introduction to Christian Philosophy, and also Geisler in his work on Christian Ethics, he argues this case and does a real good job at it. So basically what it amounts to is you don't look to the situation to determine your actions. What you do is you take that situation and then look into the Bible to find out what actions you should take, okay? So when it comes to killing, if there's an innocent little baby that's crying a little bit too loud, you don't receive an exemption in a situation like that where you can just kill the baby. However, if that little baby grows up to be a 350-pound guy and he's coming at you with a machete and he's running at you and you're cornered and you can't run and you just happen to have a 9mm pistol on you, semi-automatic, then I think you got a pretty good case for an exemption right there. But situation ethics, to be totally honest with you, I really think love determines what is right and what is wrong. I'll give that to Fletcher. I mean, Jesus even said the whole law summed up as love God with everything you got and love your neighbor as yourself. The problem is, Fletcher leaves love totally undefined. It's like that empty concept good. You fill in the blanks, okay? And whereas with us, we're not, like I said in a debate that I had, and I've said it other times, we are not experts in love when it comes to love and how love should be applied in a certain situation. We're experts on sin. We do that real good. That's why you read about words like depravity and things like that and when you read theological works. But so if we want to find out how love would respond to a given situation, you've got to read the Word. Because God is love. He's the expert on love, not us. And that's the problem with Fletcher, is he's got this empty concept called love. You fill in the blank. You know, and that's not the way it should be. Yeah.
Do you know if he's educated in Europe like the other guys?
I can't remember something. I know John Hick was from Princeton. I don't want to even say where Fletcher's from, you know, because he could have been Harvard or Yale, too. He's from a major professor at a major university in this country, I believe, or at least he was when he started writing this stuff. But I don't know where he was educated. I couldn't tell you that offhand. Turning the page, the problem with moral relativism. By the way, I'm going to be putting together the entire course in a book form. Probably just get it with the. I don't know if you guys know the way they bind it with that black plastic or the white plastic thing. And if you guys want one, let me know. I think I'm going to be able to do it for under $5, so we'll probably just charge $5 a piece for each guy that wants a book, and then you can just take that, and when you teach courses on apologetics, whether it's Sunday school or at a home Bible study, you can teach right from it yourself if you like. Or if you order the cassettes, you can, you know, listen to the cassettes and go, what's that? There you go. The problem with moral relativism is that when a person denies the absolute moral law, they cannot condemn the actions of another as evil without contradiction. Okay. Now, I had, when I lectured on creation science at Central Kitsap High School, I was sitting down eating lunch that day with two atheist teachers at Central Kitsap High School, and they got real ticked off at me, and they said, you know, well, we really hate it when you say that atheists can't be moral. I said, I never said that. And they said, yes, you did. You said atheists cannot be moral. I said, no, I didn't say that. And they said, yes, you did. I said, no, I didn't. And finally they said, well, what did you say? I said, an atheist cannot be consistent with his worldview and then, you know, teach moral values or hold to some type of moral value. And that's the key, without contradiction. Many atheists condemn the actions of other people as evil. In fact, all atheists do. In fact, the matter is, you know, they, These guys, they might deny the existence of God, but they still got to live in God's universe. And morality is a fact that they have to deal with. So they do condemn the actions of another as evil, but when they do that, they contradict their own worldview. And so any moral relativist, they cannot condemn the actions of another as evil without contradiction. Because some type of absolute standard must be resurrected in order to make the value judgment. Just to call somebody's actions wrong, you've got to bring some standard that's above you and him. You have to bring that into the picture to make the judgment. Now, if moral relativism is true, there is no basis from which to condemn the actions of an Adolf Hitler. And there was a television debate that I saw with a Jewish rabbi, and it was filmed in New York, and a homosexual, as to whether or not homosexuals should teach in the public schools. And this heavyset rabbi with a beard and mustache, he was against homosexuals teaching in the school, and the homosexual obviously was for homosexuals teaching in the school, public schools. And so the homosexual asked the rabbi, why do you think homosexuality is wrong? And the rabbi said, because it's a sin. And the homosexual said, you can't say that, you're making a moral value judgment. Well, at that point, the rabbi just held his hands up like as if to say, I give, and he just smiled like, okay, I won't argue that point. We'll just hold on to that point. And so a little bit later, about 5 minutes later, the rabbi started reading an article written by a homosexual who said he wanted to teach in the public schools and he wanted the right to have sex with any boys that consented to have sex with him that were in high school. And the other homosexual guy got upset because he thought, you know, this guy's going to try to make it look like that's my view. So the homosexual guy was getting upset, so the rabbi said, well, what's the problem here? And the homosexual guy says, I don't agree with what that guy's saying. And the rabbi said, why not? And the homosexual said, because he's wrong. And the rabbi pointed at him as if to discipline a little child and smiled, and the rabbi said, you can't say that, you're making a moral value judgment. And so what the homosexual was saying was when the rabbi condemns his actions as wrong, the homosexual says, you're not allowed to draw any lines, any boundaries when it comes to morality. Yet, he wants to reserve for himself the right to draw lines, to draw boundaries when it comes to morality. In fact, for somebody to say, it's wrong for you to condemn my actions because there's no such thing as wrong, they're contradicting themselves. If there are no moral values, if moral relativism is true, then there's nothing wrong with me condemning someone else's actions. But we all recognize actions as evil when we are wrong. And by the way, this is the basis for Christ's profound statement in Matthew 7, verse 12. I'll turn there right now. Matthew 7 and verse 12. You know, Christ could have said, treat people the way you know they should be treated. But if he had said that, you know, he knew that we would say, well, they don't deserve to be treated as good as I deserve to be treated, and we trample all over people. So instead, Christ put the shoe on our foot, and he said in Matthew 7, verse 12, therefore, however you want people to treat you, so treat them. For this is the law and the prophets. And so Christ says, think first how you want to be treated, because we all recognize actions as evil when we are wrong. And the way you want people to treat you and the way you don't want them to treat you, apply that to them. And but we all recognize actions as evil when we are wronged. If you punch a moral relativist in the nose, if he's bigger than you, he's going to punch you back. And if he's smaller than you, he's going to call the cops. But the moral relativist recognizes wrong when it's directed at him. The absolute moral law, the definition that we're going to go with for the absolute moral law, is a definition that I got from Geisler and Feinberg in their Introduction to Philosophy. And this is the definition they give. By a universal right is meant a duty that is binding on all men at all times and in all places. By a universal right is meant a duty that is binding on all men at all times and in all places. Okay, so the moral law is always intact. You can get an exemption from it if two of God's laws come into conflict, so you can't obey both. But the fact of the matter, that law is still intact. The law itself has not been removed. The Bible declares much of God's absolute moral law. In Exodus chapter 20, you have the Ten Commandments. Throughout the Old Testament, you have multitudes of God's commandments. In Matthew 5, Jesus gave the divine interpretation of the Old Testament law, that it's not just the law against physically committing adultery, but even thinking about committing adultery is sin and violates that command. Even thinking about committing murder violates the command, thou shalt not kill. And so God is dealing with sin in the inner man as well as outwardly. But the Bible declares much of God's absolute moral law, but also God reveals many aspects of his absolute moral law in our consciences, even if we're not believers. Romans 2:14 and 15 talk about the fact that God has placed in the conscience of every man knowledge of what is right and what is wrong. And we mar our consciences. Just the fact that we do make moral value judgments. I mean, look at Hitler. He was probably the most immoral man who ever lived. But even he had some idea of right and wrong. It was a warped idea of right and wrong, but he recognized there's such a thing as right and such a thing as wrong. Now, he thought it was right for the Aryan race to rule the earth, and it was wrong for anyone else to do it, and he thought it was right to kill the Jews and to experiment on the Jews and stuff, and obviously he was warped, but even he recognized that there's some concept of that which is right and that which is wrong. But he's a very extreme case for a guy whose moral judgment is messed up. But so even in the conscience of man, but that means that the Christian can argue with guys who don't even accept the Bible as God's word, because they may deny what you're saying. You know, just if you tell a guy that all men are sinners, he might verbally deny it, but deep down inside he knows he's a sinner. Deep down inside he's got a guilty conscience. And so as you begin to talk about, you know, that's why when we Christians take a stand in the political arena, if people will not accept the Bible as their moral guide in life, we can still argue, because they hopefully they've still got some of their conscience intact, and therefore it will kind of trigger the memory of what is right and what is wrong that God has written on their hearts. Now the moral dilemma, we covered this a little earlier, but we need to just discuss this a little bit more. The moral dilemma is this for the Christian: does God will something because it is good, or is something good merely because God wills it? Now the problem is, if God wills something just because it's good, then the moral law is above God. Okay? In other words, God can't command something unless it agrees with his moral law that is above him. Okay? But then the moral law would be God, because whatever is the ultimate is by definition God. So what's the other alternative? Well, maybe something is good merely because God wills it, but then the problem is the moral law is arbitrary. In other words, God could have created a universe where killing innocent babies and raping women is good, whereas feeding the hungry and helping the poor, those things would be evil. And guy just went eeny, meeny, miny, moe and decided, okay, the eenies and the meanies are evil and the minies and the moes are good. And so what's the response to this? The response is this. God wills something because it is good. So the moral law is not arbitrary. But the reason why it is good is because it is consistent with God's good nature. You see, God's will is only subject to his own nature. And his nature is good, so that which God wills will be in accordance with his good nature. It will be good, but the standard, that which is good, is not above God. God is the standard. Okay? So God's moral law flows from his will, flows from his nature, rather. God's moral law flows from his nature, so God is the ultimate standard in that which is good. In fact, C.S. Lewis used to use the problem of evil to try to say that God does not exist, and then after he became a Christian, he recognized how his view was self-refuting, because just to admit to the existence of evil meant to also admit to the existence of some ultimate standard of that which is good, from which evil was a perversion of. So C.S. Lewis recognized that if he had logically thought through his views, he would have seen that there has to be some ultimately good being in order for evil to exist. What I want to do now is just close this lecture with the argument for the absolute moral law. In fact, we might even have enough time to get started on the next lecture, too. It'd be nice if we can get all the lecture material done tonight. But the argument for the absolute moral law, we talked about this earlier on. Again, the basis of it is Romans 2, 14 and 15. All men have some idea of what is right and what is wrong, because God wrote his laws not just on tablets of stones for the Jews, but also on the hearts and the consciences of non-believers as well. First off, that everybody recognizes that certain things are right and wrong, so the question is, where did this moral law come from? Where did it originate? Point number one, the moral law does not originate with the individual, for then we could not call the actions of another person wrong, such as Hitler. If each person determines their own moral law, then one person, you know, the moral lawgiver is the individual. One moral lawgiver can't tell another moral lawgiver what moral laws to legislate, okay? So that's an obvious problem. You can't call the actions of Hitler wrong. And so every once in a while you get an atheist to admit that. The denial is forced and temporary is the way that Charles Hodge would say it. But if it's a public debate, just keep going for it, because I got a couple atheists at Olympic College to really admit some absurd things, like that I got them to admit that if you lived in the South in the 1800s, early 1800s, slavery was a good thing. And since it was good, if you go back 150 years, it might be good again 150 years from now. So finally I just reached a point where I told them, if that's what your worldview produces, you've got a sick worldview, and it's very, very unattractive. You know, just on that basis alone, I'd become a Christian if I realize the alternatives to it. But you know, when people are out there and other people that are open and they're listening to a debate like that, and they start seeing the logical consequences of the atheistic worldview.
What was that one debate? I don't remember who it was, but the atheist started chuckling and asked his opponent, are you trying to say this, that, or the other? And he goes, well, no, you are.
That was Greg Bonson, who, by the way, passed away last week. Real unfortunate. I think he was going for his third bypass surgery. And I don't know, but the recent pictures of him, I would guess he probably anywhere from 45 to 55, and there's a chance he might have been on the lower end because three bypass surgeries tends to make a man look older than he is. And so he might have been in the 45 range. I don't know, but I think he had something genetic where he just, you know, needed bypass surgery over and over. And I got the letter that he was going for it. Keep him in prayer. And James R. White, you know, the guy who wrote the King James Version controversy book. Well, he's signed up for a doctoral program with Farriston. And he really likes Bonson, so he called, when he found out that Bonson died, he called up Dr. Walston, the president of Farriston, and told him so. That's how I got the word.
Do you think he'll continue the school now?
I don't know, but he's got some wannabe Vantillians there working on master's degrees through him that he just put on staff. And so I'm hoping that one of them carries on the work. It's just a real shame, too, because we could have... Next Defenders of the Faith conference, we could have brought both him and Moreland up, and that would have been dynamite. We might even have been able to get them to debate each other. But it's real bummer. But yeah, in a debate where he debated Gordon Stein, one of the world's leading atheists, he kept the question and answer period. He kept asking the question, and Stein would give him an answer. He asked another question, Bonson asked another question, Stein gave him an answer, and it kept going on and on. And finally, Stein started seeing where the question started leading. And see, Stein's a materialist. The only thing that exists is matter, period. What? An empiricist is saying that truth can only be found through the five senses. But this guy's beyond, he's a materialist. All that exists is matter. So an empiricist might say there might exist something besides matter, but it doesn't tell us anything about reality, and only through the five senses can we learn about reality. But this guy was a materialist. Only matter exists. And so finally, Bonson just kept asking, there's a big public debate, thousands of people in the crowd, and finally the guy started chuckling, laughing, and said, and from seeing where the questions were going, and the atheist said, you're not trying to say that moral values and the laws of logic are material, are you? And Bonson said, that was my next question. And all of a sudden, everything got silent, because all of a sudden it hit this guy for the first time in his life. He recognized that in his materialism, if everything is material, there's no room for moral values or the laws of logic, and this guy holds to both of them. And so it was just... And the guy, you know, didn't back down from his position, but he just totally fell apart. I mean, there was nothing there. And there was just dead silence. And then all of a sudden you heard a slow murmur in the crowd get louder and louder until the whole place was laughing. And but he did that to Feinberg. I don't even want to get into that. He did that to Feinberg. I'll tell you when his lecture's over. I don't want it on the cassettes how he slammed Feinberg. Feinberg was his brother-in-law. He was married to Feinberg's sister or something. But is at the Evangelical Theological Society with all these theologians. But Bonson was a great debater. I mean, I didn't agree with a lot of the things that he holds to, but I sure wouldn't want to debate the guy. Anyway, the moral law doesn't originate with the individual, because then you couldn't call the actions of another person wrong. The moral law also is not created by each society, because then one society could not call the actions of another society wrong. For instance, America could not call the actions of Nazi Germany wrong. You know, America would say, we consider your actions wrong. And Nazi Germany would say, well, America, you make your own moral values, we'll make ours, you know. We're the highest thing, you know, societies. Then some atheists would argue, maybe it comes from a world consensus, but in fact the absolute moral law does not come from a world consensus, because a world consensus is not infallible. After all, the world consensus once was that the world was flat, and that we lived in a geocentric universe where the sun revolves around the earth rather than the other way around. So world consensus is not infallible, and until recently, until the Christian worldview and Western man came of age and started to apply his Christianity to the slavery issue, until that point, slavery was just a fact of life. I mean, you were just going to have the haves who would enslave the have-nots. And so the question comes up, was slavery ever right? And so this world consensus, by the way, it's getting easier. The more politically correct, the more political correctness that comes into the picture, all you have to do is take those politically correct things, okay? I mean, there was a time when just about every guy in the world treated his wife like property. Well, the Woman's Lib movement is politically correct, so it's like it's become a sacred cow. So what you do, and I'm not saying that men should treat their wives with love and should take good care of them and consider them an equal human being with them. At the same time, though, you can use that and say, well, then if you guys are saying there's no such thing as right and wrong or world consensus is right, the world consensus at one time was because the man's got bigger arms than his wife, that he could beat her up if he wants. And so this world consensus idea really shouldn't be too hard to refute. You see, world consensus and society, if we say the moral absolute moral law comes from either world consensus or society, all it does is it adds men quantitatively. But we need a moral law qualitatively above man. Okay? Something qualitatively higher, not just adding more and more men quantitatively. If we condemn the actions of the past, then we need an eternal and unchanging moral law.